Bruce, since Dave Davidson, who's another worm farming, well, call him an expert, call him a farmer anyway, using worm teas or...
He's a worm farmer.
Yeah. Have you changed anything on your farm since David's come on your farm when we did the filming?
Yes, certainly. Probably a little bit earlier, he responded to that article in Acres Australia, and we communicated, and he told me about the Vermicast tea he's been making. I've been trialling that, and I've since... last month I did a course with Soil Food Web on compost tea making and microscopy, and I'm refining that Vermicast tea making. And even at the early stage of what I put on, within 1 month I could see a difference when I stood back about a kilometre and looked between paddocks where I'd put it and hadn't put it. The evidence was quite clear that it was having an effect. So the advantage of that is that I can multiply the Vermicast significantly, so I don't have to produce as much to cover the whole farm. With worm juice, it was taking me a year to cover the whole farm. Well, since you were here about 14 weeks ago, I've already sprayed the entire farm with Vermicast tea, simply because I can brew up so much so simply. And now I'm even refining that further to hopefully improve the outcome. That's something that I've changed since coming into contact with David, and it does seem to be having a beneficial effect, and that's happening in a short space of time. At the same time, I do have some control paddocks where I'm still just putting worm juice, and I've also got two other control paddocks where I'm just putting fish, just to see the effects of the different applications, and in the long term, not only what is the best outcome, but what is the simplest management system that can be easily applied. We only have 155 hectares. Many farmers have 10 times that. So if we've got a complicated system, then it becomes too difficult to manage on a large scale. But if we can come up with a very simple system, then if I can spray 155 hectares with a 400-litre tank in steep country in 14 weeks, and you know, with a flatter country with a bigger system, I could cover 1,000 hectares in that same time. So you know, the object is to try and come up with a simple management system that has the desired outcome. So, yeah, since I've come in contact with David, I've been enlightened into the tea brewing. I was aware of it before, but I'd avoided it, thinking it was complex, but it turns out that it's not complex at all.
The extraordinary thing too, Bruce, is that what you already was doing was giving you outstanding results. What you're saying is you just sort of moved the situation to possibly be better. Maybe in the long term, the three different trial areas will come to being the same, but at this stage, there seems to be an improvement. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it seems to be, yes, yeah. And because we haven't applied anything since the drought broke 18 months ago, over the whole farm, then the whole farm is sort of starting not on a clean slate, because we've already improved it significantly from what it was, but it's starting on an even keel. So when we apply these different things, we can get a fairly good indication. And not only am I simply observing at a distance what it looks like, I'm doing Brix tests and I'm doing pH tests and penetrometer tests, and just to see overall which is going to have the best result. And recording it all, so I know what time is involved in doing it, and time and effort. Hopefully, our aim is to come up with the simplest possible system that has the best possible outcome that is achievable. There's not a lot of advantage in... Sorry, go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, then you have the improvement of the carbon in the soil. And, of course, we want the black carbon, the humus improvement, because that's soil fertility. And like worms and mycorrhizae are the ones that make those long-chain carbon compounds that are stable and don't disappear all the time with droughts. And you are well on the way in doing that. And of course, the critical part in that whole farming in your area is then to keep the blackberries under control as well.
Yes.
And with your new worm brew and the fish emulsions, have you have any way of seeing whether you can increase the productivity of those pastures affected by the blackberries, like in your goat system?
Yeah, well, we're controlling them in many of the areas with goats. In some areas we're controlling with the slasher, just to keep light on the soil surface to stimulate other plant species. I'm finding that over time, as the soil improves, the blackberries lose vigor. Once yep. there's a, it seems that there is a critical level of either soil organic matter or soil carbon, where the blackberry then loses vigor, and the goats very easily manage them. Then and I've also done trials with herbicide, where the soil's reached that stage, and it's very easily controlled with a very small amount of herbicide. But we're still experimenting with that, and well, I've got a fair bit to learn on that. I'm not in a hurry, and the council's happy to let us go. The council's weeds department aware of what we're doing with blackberry, and they're very supportive that we yeah. don't spray it out, that we do some research, because it's research no one's done. Because once, what's showing up is the blackberry is an extremely efficient plant at improving levels of soil organic matter and soil carbon, and when they reach a critical minimum level, then succession moves forward very quickly, and the blackberries are easily controlled. There could be, as one of the council weeds inspectors actually said to me recently, which was a bit of a shock to me, he said, from your research, it's showing up that there could be benefits in planting your farm out in blackberry, heaven forbid. But if you utilise goats, such as boar goats, then blackberry is their favoured diet, and goats have a very similar earning capacity to beef cattle. So it's not as though you're foregoing financial earnings, and the process shortcuts the restoration of fertility to the landscape.
Yep.
So you know, there is an outcome in the very short period of time. In our district, people have tried to rid the land of lovegrass since 1950, and it's been a total failure. However, where we've allowed the blackberry to grow, to restore fertility to the land in amongst the lovegrass, and then taken it out with herbicide once the soil organic matter and soil carbon reaches what appears to be the correct level, the lovegrass doesn't come back. The lovegrass seems to like low soil organic matter.
Low carbon soils.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess if you read Nature, it makes perfect sense, because if you look at the plant, it produces enormous amounts of organic matter. And so the sign there is that it's trying to restore organic matter in the landscape. Yep. So,
now, the same is the red tussock, also low-carbon plant, and like with loose soil, no structure, poor water availability. As soon as we increase the carbon in the soil, then we get better soil aggregation, crumb structure, then the availability of water becomes better, and then with the higher carbon, higher order species of grasses
yes.
can start to grow. And they then outcompete all the lower order species.
As you
then do the cutting of the blackberry with goats and the slashing of blackberry whenever appropriate, then that keeps the light on the soil surface for the grasses to keep growing.
Yes.
And as the grasses grow, then they pump carbon in the soil, so that process then is enhanced all the time. But as soon as you let the blackberry grow as a big bush, then it shapes the soil, grasses
yep.
can't grow underneath, so then you slow down the process.
Exactly, yes, yeah. Although it seems that the blackberry has to reach a density where it has the capacity to do that, even though we don't let it do it, it has to be dense enough to be able to do that before it is actually pumping sufficient carbon into the soil. And interestingly, with the blackberry, mycorrhizae in the soil where the blackberry is growing is very much higher than where it's not growing. So obviously, blackberry colonizes mycorrhizae very well.
Yeah.
Hmm. It's an interesting process because I'm now very pleased. When we arrived here, we were immediately pounced on by the council to control our weeds, and I pacified them around the boundaries with the blackberries, but I'm very pleased I didn't take out all the blackberries. I wasn't convinced at the time that applying poison to land, degraded land was the right way to stimulate life, and I'm very pleased.
What you've done on the property is very good, and because you see then the results, it's a whole succession of plants going from the primitive species to the higher order species.
Yes.
And as you came with a low pH, there were all the primitive species active, and there were no clovers and medic, etc. But as you then increase the mollusk collectivity with the worm juice,
yes,
then you suddenly got clovers and medics appearing, and like lap grass disappearing, etc. So
exactly, and the grasses that come in that process have very much wider leaves than the primitive lovegrass-type grasses that are very narrow-leafed and very rapidly produce seed, whereas the grasses that are coming now are very wide-leaved and very slow to produce seed and much more efficient at pumping photosynthates into the soil to support the microbes, and the process just continually accelerates.
Exactly.
Which has been a really interesting thing to observe.
Yeah, and that's for the listeners very important to be aware of, and of course many of you already have that capacity. This whole biosensitivity to sense the biology and to see what you can see or look for. Like if we don't know what to look for, we can't see things many times.
Yes.
That whole change in species. So we have to learn to see those differences in species.
Yeah, learn to see what we're looking at.
Become aware that that it's then for improvement of the whole system, because that's not only the productivity of the animals that then improves, but the whole soil is improving as the foundation for the farming commitment. And that's what we have to learn more and more. And that's like all the people that come to your property, like the official agronomists from official organizations, etc., that they haven't learned to see those positive things. And as we haven't learned to see it, we don't want to see it because our ego comes then in place as well, that we are right, we know what to look for, and you can't tell me what to do. And that's what I like talking and visiting with you and Heidi, because you don't come from that area of knowing things from the past, and you're learning all the time. And that's great, and that's what we all should do, to keep learning, because you're never there, and you keep improving the whole system.
Yes. Interestingly, last June we had a field day here, and there were some federal government officials here interested in the soil carbon aspect, and so I took some soil cores, because every field day I had been to, and I've been to a lot about soil carbon, and soil carbon's always represented as a number on an analytical report. And so I took some soil cores to show these people what soil carbon actually looked like in the ground, and they were quite astounded. They'd never seen it before. And looking at the different outcomes under different plant species, one of them said to me that they'd considered they'd learnt more in half an hour than they'd learnt in the last 10 years, because it was presented to them as it really exists in the environment.
Yeah, and that's like in the biological farming, the carbon that we talk about is black carbon, humus. And like we have the worms and the mycorrhizae and different actinomycetes, bacteria that make carbon, they all make different carbon chains. Because like those carbons in humus are like 700, 800, 900 carbons in a chain. So it's very big molecules that are stable. What the current farming is producing in our industrial system with lots of fertilizers and chemicals is soluble label carbon. And that label carbon is not black, because it's like proteins and sugars, etc., and short-chain molecules. And whenever there's a drought, those sugars are lost. The carbon goes up as CO2 in the sky. and you can't see it because it's the same color as the soil.
Mm.
And that's why the current farming has to learn to look for the humus and like to do soil tests and always have the labile fraction analyzed as well. Because I've seen like no-till systems in industrial farming that 80% of the carbon is labile, is not stable. And then we have the scientists saying, oh, yeah, you can't just increase carbon because if you increase carbon, if there's a drought, that carbon disappears. Of course it disappears when it's labile, when it's sugars and proteins and all that stuff.
That's the very nature of it.
Yeah, we have to make it the black stuff that's made by worms and mycorrhizae.
So, Martin, Martin, when you're talking about the two types of carbon, the labile and the one that you explained with the long chain of
humus.
Carbon.
Humus.
Yep. How do you see what carbon is on Bruce's place?
Well,
how would you sort of describe that?
Like you dig a hole and you see black stuff in the brown soil. And of course, if you have a black soil, it's very difficult to see black carbon. But then you have to do a soil test. But for me also, what's important is to see the crumb structure. Like as you break down the soil, it breaks down in small crumbs. Because each crumb is made by microorganisms with their glues and waxes. And whenever there are microorganisms, then worms and mycorrhizae become present as well. Because worms and mycorrhizae can't live in the soil without all those bacteria that do the groundwork of the life in the soil. So, and then in the learning phase, you can then send, whenever you send the soil sample away, you can ask the laboratory to measure the labile fraction as well. And like the Environmental Analysis Laboratory of Stellenkos University in Lismore, which is an independent laboratory not associated with fertilizer sales, so they do good tests of the biological availability. And when you pay like $20 more, then they do the labile fraction as well. So then you have the total and the total carbon and the labile carbon, and then you can see where you're going.
Great.
In addition to that, Martin, when we first started and we were doing soil analysis, I found a lab that would also measure humus content so that when we're doing annual soil tests, we could do a humus test and see that we were actually building humus. And that additional test was only $10. And then immediately, when I got a soil report back, the first thing I looked at was the humus content to see that we were actually building humus, which was the most important aspect of the entire report as far as I was concerned. And it cost only $10. And another thing I think many people don't realize about humus is that it has an exceptionally high cation exchange capacity, much higher than clay. So as soon as you build humus, you automatically are building the potential of the fertility of the soil.
Yeah, and of course humus, because the science says that humus is not stable because it can break down all the time and microbes can rework it out. But like the humus molecule has like a lifespan of 20 years or more. And then you say, oh, 20 years, that's not long enough. But like what we have to do, we don't have a drought of 20 years. So, and the carbon in the soil depends on the rainfall in the district over like 10 years. And of course, if the rainfall might go down, then the humus layer, the carbon level will go down as well. But in the peaks and troughs of a weather pattern, the carbon can stay constant and high when it's humus. Because in a 20-year period, the humus stays stable. And in the farming system, if we recreate humus all the time, every year, to get to the maximum level that the soil can hold, then the whole system is stable. And then whenever we have a drought, then carbon can't increase in the soil when we are at the maximum level. And then when the rain picks up again, the carbon is restored to that highest level. But at the moment, we come from like 1% carbon and less than 1% carbon in areas where 2%, 3%, 4% carbon was the norm at settlement 200 years ago. So we are way down from where we were before, and we can double the carbon easily in our modern farming. And Bruce is in the direction of going back to like a carbon level of 3%, organic matter of 6%, 7%, 8% in the valleys, 10%, and that's on the coast, of course, of Australia. And as we go inland, it's still like 2% of carbon, like 4% organic matter, could be the norm everywhere.
Yes, we're approaching three in some areas, 4% carbon now. I think when speaking about the longevity of humus, it's been said that it has a potential to not have a long residence in the soil and can be 10 to 20 years, but that's under conventional management. They're now discovering that under biological management, humus can last in the soil for centuries.
Not centuries. But well, like in that system, the more you have, of course, the less will be turned over. If you have very little, it will go quicker.
Of course, yes. But if you're farming biologically where you're continually building and you're increasing the store of it, then you're not actually mining out the humus, then the humus has a very long residence.
It's stable.
Very stable. Mm.